Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
Well, a week ago, unless you had taken Greek, nobody really knew what the word Omicron meant. Well, we all do now. And while we don't know what the severity of this new variant is going to be, what it does tell us is that this is going to carry into a third year as we head into 2022. What else we know is coming? U.S. midterm elections later in the fall as we transition from the sort of legislative phase of the Biden administration into the more regulatory phase. We know that there are inflation concerns out there. The Fed chair, Jerome Powell, talking about ending the taper early and perhaps spooking markets by suggesting that rates might increase earlier than had originally been expected. We will continue to struggle with the return to work issues. The fallout from the climate change conference, COP26, will continue to play out into 2022. And we've got some other major events, the Olympic Games in Beijing, and of course, the World Cup Qatar 2022. So today, we are joined by colleagues of mine from Teneo Political Risk Advisory to look at the world ahead in 2022, what they're expecting in the various regions around the world, and what we need to be thinking about. On a subsequent call, we will be looking at what we expect specifically for the United States. We've got a lot of ground to cover, so in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through the introductions. All of the bios of my colleagues are available on the Teneo.com website, but let's jump right into it. And I want to start with China. Gabe Wildow is with us. He's our lead China analyst in the United States. There is a People's Congress later fall 2022, Gabe. We expect the big headline news of that will be that Xi Jinping secures his third presidential term. But tell us about the significance of this, what you expect from that, what you expect leading up to it, and what we sort of know about Xi Jinping's position in China right now.
Thanks, Kevin. So this is a very important political year coming up in China. There's not much mystery about the basic outcome of the Party Congress, which is likely to occur in November 2022. Xi Jinping is virtually certain to secure a third term as General Secretary. On the other hand, we did see from the recent sixth plenum last month in China, the Communist Party Central Committee's big yearly meeting, that there appear still to be very significant, let's say, constraints on Xi Jinping's power within the party, both to shape internal party dynamics and personnel appointments and party rules, as well as to impose big, sweeping, controversial policy change on the country. And so that's an important thing to keep in mind as we look at the kind of the policy outlook in China for 2022, because the economy, the policy is at a crossroads in terms of the economy. The economy is slowing. And traditionally, what we've seen is leading into big political transition years, party Congress years, stimulus ramps up to ensure a positive economic background and context for the current General Secretary's attempts to consolidate his power, to appoint his allies in key positions, and to achieve his other political goals. And so this places policymakers in a tough position, because there's this commitment to try to, for example, deal with the real estate bubble, to cut China's addiction to real estate, the economy's addiction to real estate. But that's a kind of a medium to long-term structural reform type goal that conflicts with the need to boost short-term growth and therefore to boost President Xi's position heading into the Congress. So how that balance is struck, and in particular, whether the current controls and restrictions on the real estate market that are having a really big downward impact on economic growth, whether the party leadership is going to have the stomach to keep those in place and therefore to keep growth have growth be at a low level this coming year, despite the political background. So that is, I think, the big uncertainty is, are they going to go back to the old playbook of stimulus, of short-term stimulus this year, or are they going to stick to their guns on these tough housing policies, despite the short-term pain that imposes?
You know, we've seen a number of trends playing out over recent months on things like the technology front, issues surrounding listings of Chinese companies on Western markets, particularly in New York and the like. And all of these obviously feed into this kind of decoupling narrative. But what are you seeing? What's driving that? What do you expect going forward on those fronts into 2022?
I think the trend continues to be selective decoupling in particular industries and particular areas. But the idea that there's going to be a broad decoupling or disentangling of the U.S. and Chinese economies is pretty much off the table. And we've seen Biden administration officials like Gina Raimondo, the Commerce Secretary, and Catherine Tai, the trade representative, essentially say that explicitly, that they don't want decoupling, that the two economies are going to continue to be selling to each other. But at the same time, we saw just last over Thanksgiving, new Chinese companies added to the Commerce Department's entity list. In other words, new export controls restricting the sale of sensitive U.S. technology to Chinese companies. And so that's the kind of uneasy balance we're going to continue to see. 2022 is kind of another year in the new normal of U.S.-China strategic competition, where on the one hand, we may see some modest reduction in tariffs. There's signs pointing that direction in Washington. The political momentum for at least partial tariff reduction, not complete rollback, but partial reduction is building. But on the other hand, the export controls continue to strengthen, and China continues to double down on its attempts to reduce its dependence on U.S. technology, and they're girding for this long-term struggle. They're not counting on any kind of significant easing up of those controls from Washington, so they're in this long struggle to achieve less dependence and more autonomy in technology, and so we're just going to see that game continue to play out in 2022, I think, trade continues to be robust between the U.S. and China, but the export controls bite in key industries. On foreign listings, we've seen rules from Chinese regulators requiring cybersecurity reviews ahead of any Chinese company that wants to list either in New York or in Hong Kong. And I think at least in the short term, as regulators implement those rules and as companies digest the impact, the flow of U.S. Listings to the U.S., which had been very strong for the first part of 2020, despite the threat of delisting from the U.S. side because of this audit dispute and U.S. regulators' insistence that the Chinese companies disclose more about their audits, despite the threat of delisting in 2024 because of that audit dispute, we saw big flows of new IPOs from China to the U.S. in the first half of 2020, and then that cut off dramatically with the DD Global fiasco and the cybersecurity investigation that derailed their IPO. And looking ahead, IPOs, no new IPOs from China in the U.S. until this cybersecurity issue gets worked out. So the overall theme is, again, sort of partial decoupling, but still a deep degree of entanglement between the two economies.
Now, at a strategic level, though, I mean, obviously, there's kind of a one-way street between the U.S. and China, though, and leading up to the recent virtual summit between President Biden and President Xi, we saw something of a lowering of the rhetorical temperature somewhat. But what do you expect in terms of U.S.-China relations going into 2022? As I mentioned at the top, we have both the People's Congress. We also have the midterm elections in the U.S. Is that a reason for both sides to want to keep things stable as possible for their own domestic purposes, or for nationalistic reasons, will they ratchet up the rhetoric against the other side? How do you see the tone of the relationship going into the new year?
Yeah, I think the midterm elections in the U.S. and the Party Congress in China limit both sides' political space to compromise. As I mentioned earlier, in Washington, the momentum in favor of partial tariff rollback has grown, but I would say that the balance of political pressure still favors keeping most tariffs in place. And then in China, the kind of compromises or concessions that Washington would like to see from Beijing are unlikely, even more unlikely in this sensitive political year, where Xi cannot be seen to be bowing his head or making concessions to the adversary, the U.S. And so I think we, as I referred to earlier, I think it's another year in the new normal of strategic competition where sniping continues. But I think that what we did see at the Biden-Xi summit is that both sides want to sort of put a floor under relations. They want to make sure that we don't spiral into outright conflict. They want to increase communication to make sure that there are no unintended incidents that escalate. But neither are we headed for some kind of dramatic improvement. It's a year of muddle through and continued competition, continued diplomatic sniping. The Beijing Olympics are going to and this recent Peng Shuai incident is focusing attention on China's human rights record. The Biden administration is quite determined to talk tough on that and to impose sanctions in that area. And so it's another year of tensions on the one hand, combined with, again, a robust trading and investment relationship that continues.
And finally, and very quickly, I just want to ask, you know, as we head into year three of COVID, I mean, China has taken essentially a zero case objective policy, and we've seen the dramatic measures that they will take to try to achieve that. Now they seem to be about the only country in the world that's doing that. Most of the rest of the world is sort of moving from a pandemic phase to an endemic policy phase. Do you see that they will continue to try to pursue this policy? I mean, most obviously, Xi Jinping himself has not left the country in 2 years, but this has got to be having an impact on a lot of business relationships that have counted on person-to-person exchanges over the years and so on and so forth. Are they going to try to continue this?
The current signs are that they will. The zero tolerance policy has come in for a lot of criticism in foreign media, but it's very popular among the Chinese public, and there are inconveniences, as you referred to, but there was just a study from the Chinese CDC indicating that if they lift travel restrictions, they could face as many as 630,000 cases per day. That I don't know how credible that estimate is, but I think it speaks to Beijing's thinking about the risks. And they look at the trade. I referred to robust trade relationships and investment. I mean, despite the disruptions to business from the travel restrictions, we see that China's exports have been incredibly strong throughout the pandemic. We see that the foreign investment inflows into China remain strong. So I don't think the leadership is blind to the cost, but I think on balance, especially given, I mean, what we can't have and what they won't tolerate would be some kind of big outbreak just ahead of the Party Congress or just ahead of the Winter Olympics in February. So I think on balance, they're willing to accept the disruptions from zero COVID because the alternative is worse.
So speaking of COVID, I want to turn to Africa now. Thanks, Gabe, and to my colleague Anna Fruhauf, who leads our Africa coverage. Obviously, Omicron sort of was first detected in southern Africa, Botswana, I believe, and very quickly after it was established, you know, travel restrictions were imposed sort of from around the world. And seen as unfairly by many in southern Africa for their good sort of their good virus detection system, that they were penalized for telling the world about this. Talk about how this is playing out and what the implications are, Anna, for the recovery prospects in Africa now as you see it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, COVID is one of the major downsides for Africa's recovery prospects going into the new year. Omicron, I think, is really, really hits home that of the urgent need for global vaccine equity, right? We're talking about a region where with the lowest global vaccination rate, with just 10% of the population fully or partially vaccinated. And within that, you have huge gaps between the likes of Nigeria with about 3% and South Africa well over 30% and effectively having resolved its supply issue, right? So the impact for the region cannot be overstated, and the impact for the recovery prospects going into the next year. If you think about it, you know, the region is expected to trail all other world regions, even Europe, which is very unusual in 2021 and 2022.
And so Africa, like many other parts of the world, does have an election cycle each and every year. What are the big ones to anticipate this year, both in terms of the actual elections and then leading up into the following year?
Yes. Yeah, so we have the three largest economy in the region heading into tumultuous election cycles of one sort or another. We have Kenya, which is preparing for a transition post two terms of Uhuru Kenyatta. And that's traditionally a fraud process. There's a disruptive political violence that has, you know, that has real implications for the Kenyan economy usually, and tends to knock off a couple of percentage points of growth in any election year. So this is a big problem, particularly in the context of rising debt. Then we have, I would like to highlight South Africa, which doesn't have elections due formally, but it is heading into the ANC internal elective conference at the end of 2022. And of course, that will effectively decide whether Cyril Ramaphosa will be a two-term president. And then finally, Nigeria doesn't have elections due until February 2023, but that means that effectively next year will be the pre-election year, and everything will be dominating. Elections will be dominating the political agenda, with the APC and the PDP trying to determine the race of who will succeed Buhari.
So stepping away for just a second from democratic transition, let's talk about, I mean, there's been considerable degree of instability in a number of countries in West Africa in particular, that are critical to the sort of the energy transition and for mining and minerals and whatnot. But talk about that political instability. Do you see that continuing? Obviously, Ethiopia and Sudan are very much in the news on both of these fronts right now. But what do you see on that score?
Yeah, so my colleagues and I would call it a new arc of instability emerging from west to east across the Sahel, effectively. And I think what it's really teaching us that is security is returning as a macro level issue and a direct threat to political stability in a way we hadn't seen for probably the past two decades, really. So we have had six coups over the course of this year, and we have the civil war in Ethiopia that could throw the entire region into turmoil. We had the UN Secretary General saying coups are back in a big way, right? From Mali to Guinea, and of course that is fueling all sorts of issues, right? From destabilizing neighboring states to fueling transnational terrorism and shifting geopolitical alignments, particularly at a time when you have, for example, bauxite producers like Guinea becoming ever more strategic plays in the context of the green transition.
So I want to unpack that last statement just a little bit. So I think it's fair to say we would all acknowledge that the 20th century and early 21st century, a lot of geopolitics was defined by the quest for and the security of oil. And as we look at the energy transition, there are going to be different minerals that are going to be of critical importance, from lithium to cobalt to nickel to copper. And the list goes on, the rare earth metals and the like. And for all of that, the oil was actually pretty well dispersed around the world. And a lot of these other metals and minerals are very, very concentrated. Lithium, very concentrated, obviously, in Latin America and Australia. Cobalt, all you think about is the DRC, of course. So how do you see this impacting the geopolitics? And talk a little bit about the dynamic as China and the United States and other markets try to secure supply out of some very, as you just put it, unstable places.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. I think it'll sharpen geopolitical competition between the US, China, and also the EU in the race for economic and technological dominance over the coming years. We are seeing, as you've highlighted, the DRC is the main strategic play in terms of cobalt, but we also have producers of bauxite like Guinea. We have manganese and nickel in South Africa. We have copper producers, right? So all of these, many of these countries have high levels of state fragility and corruption. And so what you will probably be seeing is that The proliferation of green energy technologies could drive conflict and a host of ESG risks, supply chain and compliance risks. Because remember, what's really green about these green minerals is their application, not their extraction process.
Right, exactly. So, well, thank you. I want to. It's a perfect segue into, you know, where oil was sort of dominated the geopolitics, and that brings up the Middle East. So I want to turn now to John Alterman. He's a senior advisor to the firm, and he leads our Middle East coverage. So John, you know, as Africa and other parts of the world that have these concentrations of these minerals become, you know, into the geopolitical focus, how does that energy transition going to play out in the Middle East and especially in the coming year as this really starts to get underway?
Well, I think very unevenly. First, I want to thank Anna for giving a presentation on Africa that makes the Middle East seem like a center of stability for the world. That's an interesting shift. I think what we're really seeing over the next several years is this increased volatility in oil markets and countries trying to figure out what does that mean strategically for them. I mean, on Friday, oil prices went down 10% when they announced that they had found this Omicron variant, and then they went up 5% on Monday. Countries, national oil companies, are trying to make big decisions about investments in exploration and production over time. The whole ESG sector is affecting the amount of money that's available to companies to invest in exploration. What the energy transition looks like over time, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, what they should do now. It wouldn't surprise me if we have a period of higher oil prices that then drive people to do more creativity, invention on the green side, which then depresses the demand for oil, so oil prices go down, and then there's a shortage in exploration and production, and oil prices go up. I think we may see a tremendously cyclical market. And for governments in the region, on the one hand, that's a reminder that they have to diversify their economies and they have to get people off the expectation that they're government employees and create a genuine private sector that's competitive, all those kinds of things. And when the oil prices go up, it means you can ease that transition a little bit. But I think planning becomes tremendously difficult and setting expectations for the population becomes tremendously difficult in this really, really volatile economic environment. And the Middle East is on the tail end, both for the energy producers and for the labor producers that send labor to work in the countries that are energy producers. So really the whole Middle East gets tied to what's happening to global oil prices.
So let's put aside for 1 second the Iran nuclear negotiations. I want to get to that in a moment more specifically. But, you know, there's an evolution, obviously, in U.S. policy toward the region. Part of that is just dictated by its, you know, singular attention on China in terms of foreign affairs and the like. So how does the changing U.S. footprint impact, you know, within the context that you've just laid out? You know, how is that going to impact the stability of the region? What are some of the other trends you see on that front? Obviously, in the last few years, you know, the Abraham Accords, some of the rapprochement in terms of dealings between Israel and some of the Arab states has been a big thing. Obviously, the conflicts in places like Syria and Yemen continue to play out in their own way. How do you see the stability of the region over the next, you know, 12 months?
Well, I think the stability of the region is going to really have a lot to do with Iran, and we can talk about that in a second. I was at the UAE National Day last night at the Kennedy Center. I spoke to a lot of very senior administration officials. They're pretty dark about where things are going to go with Iran over the next 6 to 9 months and what that's going to mean for the region. But more broadly, they've been going around, they've been saying, look, we are right-sizing our ambitions in the Middle East to match the resources we have to meet those ambitions. That from the Bush administration, you know, going, we're going to transform Iraq and we're going to make the Middle East into a bunch of liberal democracies and all those kinds of things. There was a sense that the U.S. was promising things that it never had the hope of delivering and was way out of position. The Trump administration, on the one hand, had a maximum pressure campaign against Iran. They, on the other hand, said we're going to withdraw from the Middle East. And so I think what they're saying is we are going to have a much more modest footprint in the region. What countries interpret from that is the U.S. is on its way out the door, that countries have to diversify their relationships, that they want a China relationship to supplement but not supplant the U.S. relationship. They are looking at a Russia relationship, narrower, but one that fits some needs. They're looking to see if they can supplement with other European countries. Is there a relationship with India that can play some useful role? But I think for a lot of these countries, you know, by the late Clinton administration, every country in the Middle East either had a positive relationship with the United States or wanted a positive relationship with the United States. And the U.S. was really at the center. And the U.S. is sending a message to countries, do not put us at your center. And I think there's not a full appreciation of the kinds of things countries are going to do as they hedge their bets on the U.S. We just had this case a couple of weeks ago, I think, that the Chinese turned out to be building a facility at a UAE port that the Americans were concerned had an intelligence or military intent associated with it. A lot of countries are saying, so if you're going to be totally with us, be totally with us. If you're not going to be with us, don't complain when we diversify our relationships. And they're unsure, and a number of countries are also getting concerned about getting caught in a fight between the U.S. and China. With a sense of please let us know the specific boundaries and we won't cross them. The Chinese are very good at laying down specific boundaries. A lot of it has to do with treatment of the Uyghurs and other kinds of things. The U.S. is less good at it. And as people on the recipient side are getting a little bit grumpy about it, but I think they're going to have to deal with it.
So let's turn then to the Iran situation, because you know, obviously, you've had a new administration in both Iran and in the United States, so new interlocutors, though not necessarily the positions changing very much. So,
and arguably the whole U.S. team, is the team that negotiated the Iran deal under the Obama administration.
In the first place, exactly. And then when we pulled out of the JCPOA, it was a different crew running the story. Now we're back in. But what do you? I mean, it sounded like quite pessimistic what you're hearing from administration insiders. But what do you see? Is there anything positive coming out of these meetings in Vienna anytime soon?
I don't think anytime soon at all. In the longer term, maybe. I think it's a hard bet to make. As you know, I wrote a brief a few days ago that argued that I think the Iranians are looking for brinkmanship. They think that the previous team left everything on the table. They never got what they were promised from the Obama team. It was all taken away by the Trump team. They had absolutely nothing to show for their efforts. That what they are going to do, I think, is both accelerate the enrichment piece and potentially do some other things with their, you know, asymmetric threats, the ones that are hard to attribute, whether it's involving proxies in other countries in the Middle East, whether it's, you know, ships that go boom in the middle of the night, whether it's drone attacks, those kinds of things. I think the Iranians are going to try to create a sense of crisis among other countries, including the United States, with a bet that if they can create that crisis, countries will rush to make a deal with them on their terms and they'll be better off. There are two things that's counting on. One is that the U.S. can't really tighten the screws more. I think when I spoke to senior officials, including last night, they feel there are ways for them to tighten the screws. But you know, I think the Iranians look and say the Trump administration said this is a maximum pressure campaign. The Trump administration was trying to overthrow the government of the Islamic Republic, and it got nowhere. So what are we afraid of? So I'm not sure they're concerned about that. I think the other thing that people have to wonder about is, do the Israelis have any capabilities? Does the Israeli agreement with the UAE give them capabilities they didn't have before? Does the sort of wink, wink, nod, nod between the Saudis and the Israelis, it's not a visible relationship. There are invisible relationships that are strengthening. Does that give them anything in terms of overflight, refueling, whatever? I think that there's a sense the Israelis may have more cards to play. And that's where the brinkmanship comes in. You sort of have a three-way dance going on. I have to tell you, last night at the UAE National Day, I saw an awful lot of Israelis, an awful lot of Israelis. And that is a very interesting relationship. And I think it's one we need to watch, not out of concern, but I think a lot of assumptions we've made about the Middle East and about security and about even economic ties maybe out the window, because this is something the Israelis are really, really serious about and something the Emiratis are extraordinarily serious about. And so far, you know, in the first year, it's has much more traction than I thought it could.
Great. Well, thanks, John. I want to turn to Europe now. But before I do, sort of between the Middle East and Europe sits Turkey, of course. And Turkey is increasingly concerning to markets as I think, you know, the sort of policymaking becomes increasingly erratic there. And particularly alarming, considering its geopolitical position, its membership in NATO, et cetera. But Antonio Barroso is with us today. He's one of our leaders of our European coverage, works closely with Wolf Pikuli, who leads our Turkey coverage for us. But Antonio, what are you seeing and what is Wolf seeing on Turkey at the moment?
Sure. What we're seeing is that there is a lot of noise regarding 2022 and the possibility of an election, because the assumption is that Erdogan is facing so many problems that before things get worse, it will be better for him to call snap poll. However, the view of the team is that he has no incentive to do so. He will continue to manipulate the economy in an effort to essentially try to be in a stronger position in 2023. Also, it will be important to notice, and from a point of view of the opposition, is that the opposition has no way to trigger a snap poll. So, but all the noise that you might have about a potential election in 2022, we don't see it. That doesn't mean that there won't be a continued economic turmoil. We saw this morning with the replacement of the finance minister. We think that's the situation that Erdogan finds himself in and is going to continue being the default situation for the foreseeable future.
So in Europe itself, I want to get in a moment to, where we're going to evolve to in a post Angela Merkel environment. But one of the things that's going to be a determining factor of that is going to be the outcome of the major election in Europe this year, which is the French election. So maybe let's just start with your expectations on the French election itself and any other elections in Europe you want to comment on this year. But how do you see that playing out next spring?
Sure, Kevin. I think, look, let's start with the caveats. This time, in 2016, right before the 2017 election, François Fillon was supposed to be the front runner. 1 month later, a scandal emerged affecting him, and then Emmanuel Macron ended up getting the victory, right? So, you know, things are very fluid. There's a lot of electoral volatility in French elections of lately, so let's just put out there. That being said, we believe that this is incumbent President Emmanuel Macron's election to lose. Is essentially leading all opinion polls. So the true question is who's going to be facing him in the second round. The election is taking place in April, and you have a first round on the 10th of April and a second round in the 24th of April. And at this point, we see Marine Le Pen as the best place to essentially face him again in a second round. We still believe Macron will defeat Marine Le Pen because she's still perceived as too radical to win the overall contest, even though probably the margin of victory of Macron will be narrower than in 2017. Another possibility is that you have a candidate from the Republicans' party, it's a center-right party, the party of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. Interestingly, as we are having this conference call, the first round of the primary election of the Republicans just took place, and you have former Budget Minister Valérie Pécresse and a party stalwart, Eric Ciotti, going to the second round. If Pécresse wins the contest on Saturday, that might be an interesting challenger for Macron. We still think that Macron, given that he will receive some of the votes of left-wing part of the spectrum, will be in a situation to defeat Pécresse. But Pécresse will be an interesting challenge for Macron. And the third possibility is that you have the far-right polemist that has emerged from nowhere, Eric Zemmour, who is a very controversial figure, very radical, and who has suddenly emerged in the polls in recent weeks. However, his momentum has stalled, so the possibility that he might go to the second round seems to be declining. And in any case, Macron, I think, will post a strong victory in that case. So assuming that you have these scenarios, I'm just going to cover two of them to see the potential outcome. One that our clients ask us about a lot is what happens if Le Pen wins? What happens to Europe? And I don't think Le Pen will call a referendum on Brexit or anything like that, which is what people were fretting about in 2017. But make no mistake, if she wins, it will be mayhem for Europe, because she can make things very difficult for European integration. For example, not applying certain decisions taken in Brussels, by blocking decisions, by asking to renegotiate certain competences. So it will be definitely a problem for Europe. If you have a figure for the center-right winning, I think it will be business as usual, maybe some noise on the migration front, but you know, if it were to be Pécresse, it would be quite business as usual in terms of defending French interests, but in favor of European integration and so on. And to conclude with the main scenario, let's say Macron wins. Now, what you will have is in France, in Paris, and in Berlin, two of the most pro-European governments you have ever had in the history of European integration. And that's crucial, right? Because we know that the Franco-German engine is the one that pushes for European integration. So we think that in the medium term, that can only be positive for Europe, for strengthening Europe from an institutional economic standpoint. But France is France, Germany is Germany, meaning they still disagree about a lot of things, right? And so, for example, fiscal rules are now currently suspended in Europe, and they're supposed to basically get implemented again from 2023 onwards. And there is currently a debate about reforming them. And Paris and Berlin have different views of how to do it. So that's going to be a tough discussion. You might have some kind of agreement towards the end of next year. But just to remind everybody, the fact that you have two very pro-European governments in Paris and Berlin doesn't mean that you will immediately have a leap towards more European integration.
So you brought up Germany here. Obviously, after 16 years, imminent departure of Angela Merkel, and not only is she leaving as the most popular politician in Germany, she is leaving as the most respected politician in the world. And, you know, assume for and Scholz, her successor, in the chancellery is well known, obviously, in political circles and diplomatic circles, but obviously doesn't have the global stature that she does. Assume for a moment that your Le Pen scenario does not play out, that that Macron is reelected, and while he has had global stage ambitions, he also doesn't really have the stature that Merkel does. So talk about Europe's position in the world in a post-Merkel environment. Is there a vacuum of leadership there, and does that have any implications for European position economically, strategically, et cetera, and in the sort of in the cross-current, crossfire of the China-U.S. relationship?
Sure. I don't think you will have a vacuum of leadership. If anything, you might have too much leadership with Scholz that is trying to reassert himself as one of the leading figures in Europe, and Macron, that if he gets re-election, he will only, push more strongly in favor of things such as economic sovereignty, technological sovereignty, things that he really feels strong about. But look, at the end of the day, the problem for Europe is structural in the sense that there is truly among policymakers the realization that you need to have a more coherent and strong common position on certain things, such as China. But you still have divergent opinions on certain issues, right? And let's go to China for a second. I like what Gabe mentioned, the new normal of U.S. and Europe and China relations, sorry. And my sense is that Europe and China are still trying to find what the new normal of the relationship between the two of them is, in the sense that, at the same time last year, you had Angela Merkel, Emmanuel Macron, and the European Commission pushing for the concluding of the comprehensive agreement on investment between the EU and China. Now, that's in the freezer because of sanctions that Europe imposed on China and the counter-sanctions that China imposed. Now you have in Germany a green minister in charge of trade, which makes everything more difficult because the Greens have been traditionally quite aggressive on the issue of human rights. They give it a lot of importance, both in Germany and in the European Parliament. But at the end of the day, Germany is still an export-dependent country, right? And these are leaders that know that they cannot go all the way aggressive on China. And I think on that front, I think my assessment is that what both sides are going to be looking for is maybe trying not to regress in that relationship. I don't see any strong wins that you can make in terms of bilateral agreements or anything like that, because you have structural trends that are taking place that make that very difficult. For example, the EU is supposed to pass a supply chain due diligence law, propose it and then negotiate it in the coming months, which will basically impose obligations on firms to monitor human rights issues in these supply chains. That can create some tensions with China. The EU is also developing what they're called autonomous instruments against unfair trade practices. They don't mention China, but practically they are basically targeted towards China. And, you know, if you want any kind of improvement for CAI, for the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment to be approved, you will have to see some move on China, some detente, lifting the sanctions, but also some kind of movement, rapprochement towards the EU, for things to basically be unfrozen. And that doesn't seem to be on the horizon, right? So I think what you can expect is, from time to time, there might be some rhetorical tensions, but I think the objective is non-regression to make sure that you keep trading and that things don't get worse between the two sides.
You know, before we leave Europe, I want to touch base on Russia here for just a moment. There's great concern in the international community about Russian troop movements along Ukraine. Clearly, Putin retains his ability to be incredibly disruptive in global politics and has always operated along this sort of, keep pushing until you feel steel. And he just always feels mush, essentially. And so, he pursues his revanchist policies. What are we really watching here on the Russia front at this time?
Well, I think one of the main hot points, as everybody knows, is Ukraine. And there's the constant concern about whether Russia will proceed with a military incursion in Ukraine that might make things worse. Our view, the view of our team, is that action will carry more risks than opportunities, because you will see media sanctions from the EU and the US, and that's something that Putin doesn't seem to want. Now, that doesn't mean that Putin will not continue creating chaos, because he's very comfortable with chaos, and he knows that Europeans are not comfortable with instability and with conflict, right? So probably what we will see is Putin continue to, continue to basically be a pain in the neck of the Europeans through all these different actions at the border with Belarus and so on, trying to put pressure on the Europeans and also the US to make sure that, they don't support very strongly Ukraine, that it has the objective of making sure that you guarantee that Ukraine will never join NATO and so on and so forth. But, the view of our team is that at the end of the day, you should never see an end goal in Putin's actions. He's comfortable with chaos. He derives benefits from that. So we should assume that that should be the default situation going forward in the next 12 months.
Great. Thank you. Let's spin the globe here a little bit further and move on to Latin America. Nicholas Watson leads our Latin American coverage, and he's with us today. The big election in the region next year, obviously, is Brazil. So what are our expectations on that front, Nicholas?
Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, I guess it's, first of all, just worth mentioning that the elections don't take place until October, which leaves plenty of time for campaign twists and turns between now and then. But I think that the essential electoral equation is a highly polarized contest between left, as represented by Lula, and right, in the shape of Bolsonaro. There are several centrists who insert themselves into the contest. The most notable is the former judge and justice minister, Sergio Moro. But it looks like an uphill battle for any of these centrists to make it into the runoff. I think Bolsonaro's got some real challenges this time around. The economic outlook doesn't look particularly bright for Brazil in 2022. The economy is unlikely to grow much more than 1%. Some are already forecasting a recession, a mild recession. Inflation is up to double digits, highest levels in 20 years. Bolsonaro also, he obviously faces the Lula challenge, but he'll also be under attack from all of these centrists led by Moro. And then finally, I think it's very difficult for Bolsonaro to present himself this time around as the anti-corruption champion, given that his politician sons are under investigation for corruption. And he's just joined one of the kind of big center, opportunistic, corruption-tainted parties himself. Having said that, I don't think we can rule him out of contention. Lula is still a divisive figure in Brazil. There's a lot of anti-PT sentiment. And of course, perhaps more importantly, Bolsonaro is also going to be making use of this revamped cash transfer program that hugely boosted his approval ratings earlier on in the pandemic. And then just finally, I think it's also worth just saying it will be a bumpy ride ahead for Brazil. Some of the rhetoric that Bolsonaro has come up with is extreme. You know, he said he sees three alternatives for his future in 2022, being arrested, being killed, or victory. And he said he will never be arrested. So that just leaves death or victory. I think we can, you know, put that down to some Bolsonaro bravado. And there's no indication that the military would be prepared to follow him blindly in some kind of extra constitutional adventure. But I think that kind of rhetoric and the fact that Bolsonaro has been prepared to mobilize his hardcore supporters on the streets means that, you know, we're in for a bumpy ride ahead in Brazil.
So, you know, we had clearly a number of elections in 2021 in Spanish-speaking Latin America, and certain trends kind of presented themselves. How do you see that carrying on into 2022 and beyond? I mean, analytically, what are you discerning on that front?
I think anti-incumbency is the one big trend that we can see, much more than the old pink tide kind of theory of left-leaning and swings in the cycle. You know, this year we saw Peru, Ecuador, Chile, Argentina, even Honduras last weekend, all swinging against the incumbents. And I think that the same might be true of Brazil, as we've just been talking about, and also in the case of Colombia, where Gustavo Petro, yes, he's a leftist, but I think his chief value going into this election, which takes place over May and June, is that he's something different, that he can offer something different. And governments have struggled with COVID across the region. There's a real economic dissatisfaction. And in fact, that predates the pandemic, it's important to add, in a number of countries. And governments just not delivering in the ways that citizens want.
And I know that, you know, there are some other, not elections, but there are other votes that are potentially pending out there in both Mexico and Chile, let's say, that may be underappreciated because they're not seen as elections, but could have import to investors and corporate investors alike. What's going on that front?
Yeah, absolutely. Mexico should hold a presidential recall referendum, which is being organized at the behest of the president himself. This isn't some citizen movement trying to oust the president. This is the president wanting it himself. They're doing a signature collection drive at the moment, so it's not absolutely set in stone that it will happen. We should know by the end of the month. If it takes place, it would be probably in April. And really, the idea is but behind this, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO, as he's known, really to kind of reboot his presidency. It's a six-year presidency, single term. 6 years is a long time in Mexican politics. He's halfway through, exactly. So he wants to give himself new, fresh momentum for the second half, control the succession, paper over divisions within his often divided Morena party, and basically maintain his authority and keep the opposition divided. That's the purpose of the Mexican referendum. Moving to Chile, the country's obviously been going through a process of constitutional change. And as part of that, a constituent assembly is sitting, has been in session since July. And the arrangement was that when the Constituent Assembly finishes its work, there'll be an exit referendum to either endorse or reject the new document that the Constituent Assembly comes up with. So in theory, that should happen in August or September. But what makes it so uncertain is that we're in a parallel electoral process, which is the presidential election. Chile has unfinished business even in 2021 because we've got the second round coming up on the 19th of December. And that is another highly polarized contest between right, in the shape of José Antonio Kast, and the left, a new kind of younger, more radical populist left, represented by Gabriel Boric. And it's very difficult to say which way that's going to go. And it's obviously a really binary choice going in two quite different directions. But the fact that the Constituent Assembly is also sitting makes this very, very uncertain for the country. For example, if the leftist wins but is blocked in Congress, as it looks like he would be, might he try and insert some of his proposals into the Constitution? What kind of reaction would that have? If the right winger wins, will he campaign against the new Constitution? In which case, the question arises, well, if the new Constitution is rejected, does that set off new rounds of unrest of the type that we saw in 2019? So a lot of uncertainty for Chile.
So before we leave Latin America, one last question for you, which is that institutional investors are perennially concerned with Argentina and its negotiations with the IMF. So what to expect on that front?
Yeah, I mean, as ever, it's the big question facing Argentina. The government has been chalking up its chances of reaching a deal soon, possibly before the end of this year. I think that reflects the fact that they've got a big payment, almost $1.9 billion. It's due on the 22nd of December. They would quite like an early Christmas gift of maybe not having to make that payment. I think realistically the talks are likely to stretch on into early 2022. There is a finance ministry team going to Washington, D.C. this coming weekend. So we should get, I expect, some fine-tuning of figures that will go into a medium-term economic plan, which the government has said it will sent to Congress in December. That plan is a prerequisite for any deal. So plan first, and then there'll be some more talks, I expect. But the pressure's on. $19 billion Argentina needs to pay to the IMF over 2022. That's unpayable. They have less than $5 billion in net reserves currently. And it's not budgeted either. So the budget for 2022 is predicated on an agreement being reached. I think the best case scenario is some kind of soft or very light deal that's reached before March. Everything needs to be settled by March because there are some big payments due, both to the fund and the Paris Club. Worst case scenario, Argentina goes into arrears with the IMF.
Got it. Thank you. And we started with Asia. We're going to end with Asia today. And my longtime colleague Bob Herrera Lim is on the line. And first of all, I just want to say I appreciate you joining us so late in the night from Manila, Bob. But we've been talking about a lot of elections in various regions of the world. There are elections upcoming in non-China Asia as well. So tell us about the dynamic going into next year.
Okay, Kevin, thank you. So, you know, Southeast Asia reminds me of those old science fiction movies, right, where there are lots of lights flashing, lots of buttons that are going to be pushed this year, and you're wondering what's going to happen next. There are three overlays to this. First is the U.S., right? The elections in South Korea will affect how that country manages its relations, not only with the U.S., but with the Quad and with China and Japan. And you have the Democratic Party, which favors a more peninsular outlook, basically concerned with a more inward-looking foreign policy. And then you have the PPP, the conservatives, who are more looking towards the traditional security relationships, having relationships with the Quad, offering an olive branch to basically Japan and taking a firmer line towards Pyongyang. So that will affect how the region shapes up economically. That's the first thing. The second thing is you will have elections as well in the Philippines, and in the Philippines as well. That's the second election that's scheduled for South for Asia. Now, the challenge for the Philippines is the leading candidate is Marcos, the son of the former autocrat. Now, that has a lot of baggage for the United States, because for a decade or so, the U.S. was the prime patron of Marcos with all the military supplies and aid. But then Dick Lugar called in 1986 and said it's time to cut and cut cleanly. And you don't know which part of the Marcos family or which side the Marcos family sees. You know, the U.S. as somebody that helped their father or a country that abandoned their father. So, and for any U.S. president, it's going to be uncomfortable standing on the same platform as the Marcoses. But then you have this question, the Philippines is critical to, shall we say, defining security, at least in Southeast Asia. There's some of the longest standing security relationships with the United States. It is on the porch of the flashpoint that is the South China Sea. So how the elections in the Philippines turn out could as well affect regional security and what happens with that. Now, there are two other elections that might or might not be happening. We think they'll be happening, but they'll be less consequential regionally because for two reasons. The first is these are going to be weak coalition governments. So they're going to be focused on their domestic politics and how to manage their domestic economies, and that's in Thailand and Malaysia. It weakens the probability of domestic reform, but it doesn't affect regional geopolitics as much. Now, there are other transitions we could be watching. In Cambodia, Hun Sen just announced that his son, Hun Manet, destined to succeed him. Hun Manet is a graduate of West Point and the University of Bristol. He will be much more acceptable to Western observers compared to his father, you know, with the Khmer Rouge ties. So these are all things that could be affecting how the U.S. approaches Southeast Asia. And obviously, you have the effects of the elections from Japan and the effects on how Japan will try to increase its economic security towards China in terms of supply chain. So it's going to be a very, very complicated picture, and we're not even talking about what's in Myanmar yet.
Well, you brought up Myanmar, so why don't you talk a bit about that? I mean, it's basically sort of teetering on failed state status in a sense. But where do you see that going?
Okay, so you basically have a junta that was voted out of office and is unpopular with the overwhelming part of the population. The challenge is, 20 years ago, this would have been a scenario where basically, because of the lack of internet, because of the lack of organization, people have said, it's like, who can challenge the generals? But right now, people are, even, you know, months after the coup, emboldened, basically resist the generals. If you take a look in the streets of Yangon or any of the cities, there are sandbags around government offices. There are sandbags around police outposts because they are that worried. And, you know, the question is Myanmar right now in civil war? And the interesting thing about this is Myanmar is also a chessboard game. It's part of the chessboard game, right? 10 years ago, people were so optimistic that it could become the next frontier economy following after Vietnam. So you had ADB, you had World Bank, all the Western institutions filing in, hoping that the country becomes the next Vietnam. But now, you know, does it go back? Does it go to China? Does Russia try to play a role as a patron state? And then do you have India with its own interests in Myanmar? So this is another, you know, point where the geopolitics of the region could also become enmeshed.
So it was my job to land the plane on time. I'm going to fail to do that because I'm hoping everybody will indulge me with just a couple more questions for Bob here. But Bob, one thing is on the COVID front, COVID policy front. Obviously, just thinking about the resiliency of the region and the policies that are in place, the vaccine policies and the like. A lot of these countries are highly tourism dependent, but I also want to talk about the supply chain dependency. We've seen the impact on places like Vietnam and whatnot after going through COVID and getting away, you know, relatively unscathed until Delta hit, and then things got very, very bad, and that had supply chain implications. How do you see COVID playing out in the region as we head into year three?
Well, the hope among many governments is that the vaccines work. Okay, vaccine hesitation is not an issue in Southeast Asia. If you tell Southeast Asians 6 months from now you need your fifth jab because of the last letter of the Greek alphabet being used up, they will line up for that jab and they will ask for another jab if needed be. Okay, because that's what people would like, because they would like to get on with their lives. So, you know, and like in the Philippines, when this started, vaccine hesitancy was around 60%, now down to 30%. It's a challenge of getting more of the infrastructure, syringes, cold chain established in countries like Indonesia and in the Philippines. But in terms of vaccine hesitation, it's going down significantly in the region, which is good news for supply chains. The challenge really is that because of the integration of the region, in terms of people flows, in terms of goods flows, you know, moving away from the the challenge has been moving people's mentality away from the COVID, shall we say, zero policy. And the second is building their confidence in healthcare, that they can get sick. If they can get sick, they will be treated at a reasonable cost. That is something that is available in most Western countries. It's not available in many of the larger countries. So the challenge with COVID is not really the vaccine hesitation. It's getting the healthcare system in place so that people will become more confident that if they get sick, they can still, you know, be treated at a decent price, go back to work, and be able to do their jobs, which is what it did not happen in Vietnam. That's why we've had disruptions in Vietnam over the past 3 months.
My last question on this front is on the Asia front is that obviously we've talked a lot about, you know, and this is, I know it's sort of sloppy shorthand and we can debate the use of the term, but this Cold War that is emerging between the United States and China, a lot of this is going to play out in the neighborhood. The most dramatic news we saw of the past of this past year was the nuclear submarine deal between the United States and the UK and Australia. But we have, you know, we've seen China continuing to militarize and make territorial claims in the South and East China Seas. They're building up their blue water navy, et cetera. How much more challenging over the course of this year is it going to be for all of these countries, from Australia to the Philippines and Indonesia, Malaysia, and all the rest, to kind of thread the needle between the security and economic realities that exist between the United States and China?
Okay, that's going to be the big challenge, because the U.S. is coming in. It's actually done better than many people expected, right? Biden attended the summit, and then you had Blinken, Austin all going through, and even Vice President Kamala Harris all coming through. So even Southeast Asia itself is seeing the U.S. as, you know, a little bit more credible than in the past. Now, when this happens, then the countries in the region start to think of their own interests in terms of how do they define themselves with the big players, right? Southeast Asia is a price taker in terms of geopolitical risk, in terms of geopolitical positioning in the region. And what's going to happen next, I think, is that as these positions become much more clearer, the countries will try in Southeast Asia to have a much more unified voice. Right. So you will have a new player, or not a new player, but a stronger player, which is ASEAN, emphasizing ASEAN centrality. So this is how I think they will try to thread the needle. Say, OK, we have to put ASEAN's interest at heart, which is trade, which is maintaining the balance between economics and politics, keeping goods flowing, accessing markets, all these things. And so your question is, how does Southeast Asia thread this, or not this? East Asia thread is through the idea of ASEAN centrality, and basically saying, okay, we have to think about the things that matter to us, because the, you know, the elephants are playing and we don't want to be the grass that gets trampled.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachawara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.